I may sputter along tonight, nip a little way as I go, but I've got to do it. Due to popular demand, Nelson and Jody Wallace will be having their annual Christmas party Friday, December the 2nd, 21st rather, December 21, 6:30 p.m. We will be having the exciting white elephant gift exchange. I'm still hearing things about the last time, so it'll be interesting. This is for married couples. This is married couples get equal time to the singles outings. So that's December 21, 6:30 p.m. All right, I know Cole's here tonight. Cole, I've got to remind you that I forgot those cards. You should have been here Wednesday night. I had them. Cole is anxious to see these that I have. I actually have Mickey Mantle's card. I have some of the very old-timers. This is a little something we've collected. He collects cards I used to, baseball cards, and I told him I would bring them. So I'll take that up with you later, Cole. All right, let's go to Genesis 29. Genesis 29. We've all heard the statement, the chickens have come home to roost. Well, we're going to see that in Jacob's life. The principle of Galatians 6, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Jacob the deceiver, he is engaged in deception at least twice in his life. By the time we meet him, as he comes to Haran, it would be good to look at Jacob's life and to see how this episode in Haran fits in and how we can appreciate the lessons that God is about to teach Jacob. Because you and I are candidates for the same lesson. When we indulge in sin, any kind of sin, that we can expect to fall under the principle of sowing and reaping. Sowing and reaping. Jacob sowed, he reaped. Jacob's life divides itself into four parts. The first part of his life takes the time up when he lived in Beersheba. This is in the land, the promised land. The first 60 years of his life, chapter 25, verse 24, through chapter 28 and verse 9. This period of his life we may call deception. The first 60 years. Then we met him last week, the closing of that period, in Bethel, where God meets him. And in a dream, he sees a ladder, actually a stairway, angels ascending and descending. God teaches Jacob something. Jacob, though you may not have thought about me a lot, I'm with you. I'm with you, and I am providentially working in your life to bring about my purposes. Now we meet him in chapter 29, and this is the next period in his life in Haran. In Haran, chapters 29 and 30. He is in Haran for 20 years. It is here where the deceiver is disciplined. I would call the second phase of his life divine discipline. The chickens come home to roost in Haran. The second or the third part of his life, he's back in Canaan again, meets his brother. This, the dividing line, chapter 31, but chapters 32 through 45. And then the final period of his life in Egypt, chapters 46 to the end of the book. He is there for 17 years. He dies 1858 B.C. Those are the four periods in Jacob's life. Beersheba, up to Haran, back to Canaan, down to Egypt. We are at this point in his life as he journeys to Haran. Watch the principle. Watch it carefully. Whatsoever you sow, you'll reap. Jacob is taught a lesson in sowing and reaping. And I want to show you three essential principles involved in sowing and reaping. What kind of sowing are you doing? What kind of seed are you sowing? Let's see what Jacob has sown. Let's see. This sideline here in this part of his life, this is where he meets his wife, or should I say his wives. And he will, in that experience, enter into further discipline. For his experience in Haran divides itself into three parts, 7, 7, and 6. 7 years, 7 years, and 6 years. I'll show you how this divides up. Chapter 29, verses 1 through 30. The first 7 years, two wives. The second 7 years, beginning at verse 31 of this 29th chapter, 12 children. And then finally, beginning at verse 25, prosperity, material prosperity. Well, let's take just those two phases, 7 and 7, the first 14 years. His two wives. Now, romanticists, you can pick up. This is a sidelight to the main issue, but you'll enjoy it. Let's look. The two wives. Jacob went on his journey. You'll notice in your margin that it says that he lifted up his feet. Only occurrence of that phraseology in the Hebrew in the Old Testament. I believe that the reason for it is that it pictures Jacob's eagerness to get out and on with his life in view of his Bethel experience. He has been given an extraordinary promise by God. He has been promised, reminded of the fact of the access of the child of God with God in fellowship, uninterrupted, and how God providentially provides. Jacob was encouraged. He had every reason, well, excuse, to be discouraged, and he was. But God comes and encourages him in that dream. Jacob's eager to get up and to see God work. He went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. Let's see the place at which he arrives. It's a journey of approximately 450 miles. Having left Beersheba here, down near the city of Hebron, well, here it is, down at the southern part, south of the Dead Sea, the journey back to Haran. Difficult trip, probably took him maybe a month to make this trip. He looked and he saw a well in the field. Behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it. For from them, from that well, they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, statement of a custom here, giving us background for the meeting that he's going to have with his shepherds and with Rachel. They then would roll the stone from the mouth of the well, water the sheep, put the stone back in its place at the mouth of the well. So Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" They said, "We're from Haran." What was Haran? It's not all that big on the map these days. It was a very important place in Jacob's day because it was strategically located on a trade route, east to west. It was on a tributary of the Euphrates River, sitting here in the Mesopotamian plain. Haran, which today is in just the very southern part of Turkey, just across the border from Syria, is the place where Abraham passed through and on his way to Canaan. He stayed there for a while. His brother stayed there while Abraham came on south to Canaan. Nahor stayed in Haran. And this is why Jacob goes back. He finds family, and he will meet on the first occasion one of the family of Nahor himself. He will meet Laban, the grandson of Nahor. God is working providentially. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" They said, "We know him." Now let's stop and let's think about Laban for a minute. It's a little humorous in a way. Jacob is going to meet somebody that out-Jacobs Jacob. You talk about a shrewd man. You watch this Laban. Now, he's the brother of Rebekah. So this is his uncle. This is Jacob's uncle, the grandson of Nahor. From what we can tell, he was a worshiper of idols, though he also worshiped Yahweh, the Lord. It seems that he just worshiped the Lord along with the other idols. Cover his tracks, I guess. Shrewd man that he was, any god that he could bring in on his idolship, good enough for him. But the thing that's most outstanding about Laban is his lack of character. He was proud. He was greedy. He was selfish. He was untrustworthy. He's a liar. And Jacob is going to have to live with him. 20 years. How'd you like to live with somebody like Laban for 20 years? Let me tell you, that's part of Jacob's discipline. Tell you this about Laban. You can learn a lesson. God quite often will send somebody like Laban into your life. It's like God's chisel. God uses them to shape you. God uses Laban to accomplish his purposes in Jacob's life. God is going to use Laban to discipline Jacob. And I see a very, very practical lesson here. Is that God may very well have brought or be bringing into your life somebody like Laban. They're going to be difficult to work with. They're going to be rude. They're going to be greedy or selfish or proud or deceitful or all of them. Maybe in the office. Maybe at school. Maybe in the home. Can be anywhere. But I think that we ought to understand that God will choose to bring Laban-like people along just to work his purposes out in your life. It's what he's going to do with Jacob, because Jacob is going to be out Jacob. He meets his match and more in Laban. You watch how shrewd he is. The chickens come home to roost, Jacob. You treated Esau deceptively. Look what Laban's going to do to you. You think Jacob will learn anything? I think he does. I think he does learn something. He has to see some things here. You'll see it. Well, now let's get to the romance. So much for old Laban. We'll get back to him. He said to them, "It's well with him." He's doing fine. They said, "It's well, and behold, Rachel, look, she's coming. There's right down the road." How about that for providence? But you know what? Oh, I wish this could be the perfect romantic story for you. I really do. But it can't. Because Jacob is going to meet the wrong woman very first. It was not God's will for Jacob to marry Rachel. But she is the one he meets first. And you know what? It looks like it just has to be the right one, doesn't it? When you start reading it. He takes this 450-mile trip, gets to Haran, is looking for the family of Nahor, finds his mother's brother, They know about him, and as at the very time he asks, who comes down the road but this beautiful gal named Rachel? And he is going to talk to her, meet her, and he's going to be impressed by her bright, shining eyes and her good shape. But you know what? All of that, which is certainly providential, but yet it is not saying to Jacob, marry her, Jacob. Does that surprise you? How do we know which is the right one, Leah or Rachel? Well, let's get along a little ways, and I'll show you. But here she comes. Here comes Rachel. What are we going to call her? Well, let's look at her Hebrew name. And let's see. I'm sorry, Rachel. Here's the way it looks in the Hebrew. Comes out like this, R-A-C-H-E-L, pronounced Raquel. But we'll call Rachel Rachel, not Raquel. Wouldn't want to do her that disservice. So here comes Raquel. And Lamar, let me tell you, to Jacob, she's like a Raquel. Because look what it says. He says, look what Jacob does here. Jacob's a shrewd fellow. His mind's always working ahead of everybody else. Just like his mother, scheming, figuring things out, getting people to the right spots at the right time to accomplish his purposes. And he talks to the shepherd and says, behold, it's still the high day. That is, the sun is still high. And look, it's not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go and pasture them. Sir, get out of here. I'd like to talk to this doll by herself. That's what he's up to. They said, we cannot. Until all the flocks are gathered and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well, then we water the sheep. And so they say, well, I don't think they want to miss this meeting either. This would be interesting. Here comes this fellow all the way down here from Canaan, up here looking for this family, meets her for the first time. And she's a nice looker. I guess they'd like to see what this little rendezvous is going to be all about. And while he was speaking with them, Raquel, Rachel, came with her father's sheep, and she was a shepherdess. It came about when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban. Now notice how often the author draws attention to the fact that it's his mother's brother. That he saw Rachel. Now look, he sees two things. Watch this man. He sees Rachel, and he sees the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. He sees the sheep? What's that? This is a man of means. She is his daughter. She's nice to look at. This man's got some money. Roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Now, his adrenaline's really pumping here. Now, look, these shepherds are all coming there together, not just to get all their sheep in there to get them watered, but it's a man-sized job to move that stone. Maybe a couple, three of these shepherds. They seem to be a little passive anyway, hanging out around this well in the middle of the day and in no hurry to do anything. And it might take all three of them, grunting and groaning, to move it. But Jacob's adrenaline is flowing. He wants to impress this doll. So he says, look out and move out of the way. And he just flexes and he moves the stone right over out of the way. She's impressed. So he goes on further with this conversation. Now he rolled the stone from the mouth of the well, watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. Now what about that? Don't you think that's a little forward? This is no pretext for any kind of forward activity on your part, fellas. So let me put this in its cultural context. We're talking about custom, though it could very well have been love at first sight. If love, at least attraction. He likes what he sees, but this is custom. The women in that part of the Middle East, around Haran, they didn't wear veils out in the middle of the day working like this as she would as a shepherdess. And so it's probably he's overwhelmed with meeting not only somebody to whom he's related. Here is the family that he's looking for, but she's good looking too. Jacob seems to be a very emotional person. Now, Jacob weeping, I'll let you figure that out. After kissing her, he just breaks down and cries. Do with that what you will. Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father, that he was Rebekah's son. She ran and told her father. So as soon as it came out, Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son. Then he ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him to his house. Then he related to Laban all these things. Laban said to him, "Surely you're bone of my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you're my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should be your wages?" Now Laban had two daughters. The plot's going to get a little complicated now. The name of the older was Leah. Looks like this in the Hebrew. Leah. And in all fairness to her, we're not saying that there is any resemblance between her name and its meaning. It means wild cow. That is what Leah means. Statement is made about the way she looks. It says that Leah's eyes were weak. Now we must interpret the passage grammatically and therefore correctly. It does not mean that she had to wear glasses if they had been available. It means that they lacked luster. They lacked brightness. Well, eyes were very important, especially the eyes on the women, were very important to the Oriental. They measured a woman by the brightness of her eyes. This is why, for instance, mascara, eyeshadow, that kind of thing, for centuries back, the cosmetology of the eyes has been important to the Oriental women. But apparently that didn't help her eyes a whole lot. You've seen this commercial on TV. They get this girl. She's looking real dour. And she knows she's got pale with eyelashes. And she's just real pitiful looking. Then all of a sudden this cosmology is worked upon her. And her face, her eyes come alive and her face is aglow. Okay, before and after. Leah is before. Rachel is the one after. Rachel was beautiful. A form and face. That is, she had a good figure, and she was good looking. Now, Jacob's already noticed that because he kissed her and then cried. So he's impressed by Rachel. Now, Jacob loved Rachel. He's been there a month, and that's time enough to get things going. And he's impressed with her, to say the least. And he has a plan. He said, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Why 7 years? I think that he probably loved her so much that he wasn't going to take any chance of being turned down. 7 years? That's the dowry price. Ordinarily, it would have been expected for a young man to pay a dowry price to replace what the father would have lost in the loss of a daughter. That might not be a bad idea, fathers, if you want to keep certain fellows away. How about a dowry price? In these days of inflation, that might be helpful, though the daughters might not appreciate it. Well, he didn't want a risk of refusal, but Jacob's met his match. Well, Laban's going to take him up on that. Maybe, you know, it's just possible that Laban wants somebody to serve as an heir. This is possible. Like we know that Abraham was looking, this was a custom in that in the world in that time, to look for an heir and to take the position of the firstborn. Maybe he didn't have any sons. Anyway, Laban said, "It's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." Now notice, he's real vague here. He's not coming right out and saying, okay. But he covers his tracks. He says, "It's better that I do this than I give her to somebody else," but he doesn't say when. He doesn't say for sure. Well, there it is. Now, Laban's already worked it out in his mind. He's going to exploit this fellow Jacob. Probably Laban says, this kid, he doesn't know what he has just asked. So he's going to exploit Jacob. Did Jacob ever exploit anybody? "I'm about to starve to death. Oh, I've got to have something to eat. I'll die." "Okay, I'll fix you something nice and savory. How about a little venison stew, Esau, if you'll sell me your birthright?" Okay. You think that started coming back to his mind here in a minute? Had to. Look, it says, Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my time is completed. Now, no mention of name. Plays right into Laban's hands here. My time is completed, and I may go into her. Laban gathered all the men of the place, made a feast. And it came about in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Now, this might seem a bit strange. It says that he gave him Leah, but Jacob doesn't recognize her. It's in the evening. No lights. She probably has a veil on. It's really not an extraordinary thing due to the modesty of women in that part of the world. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah, she's going to come into the picture later, that's why she's mentioned here, to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. What a letdown. He said to Laban, what is this you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me? The deceiver has been deceived. Look at it. Jacob preferred Rachel for the physical reason. Jacob was trying to take the advantage of the situation, serving 7 years to get Rachel. Laban, though, one-ups him. He will take an advantage of Jacob's preference for Rachel rather than Leah and exploit it, just like Jacob did. Do you remember Isaac, who preferred the Esau rather than Jacob for the physical reason? And now here is Jacob entering, or has to be reminded, of the deception into which he entered using the physical. Isaac, he preferred Esau. He was a hunter. Jacob preferred Rachel because she was pretty. But it was Jacob that was chosen by God, and it was Leah who was chosen by God to be his wife. Do you see the parallel? Jacob does not to him marry. He should have kept Leah. Now, God is overruling him here. God is overruling Jacob, because he should not now have taken Rachel. He becomes a bigamist, and that is going to create some problems. Well, let's see what happens. Laban said, it's not the practice in our place to marry off the young before the firstborn. That is our custom around here. You married, got to marry the older one first. Okay. Complete the bridal week. That's the week of the festivities, the partying. We will give you the other also for the service which you will serve with me for another 7 years. Now, he gets Rachel at the end of the bridal week, but he's still got to hang around and serve 7 more years. Jacob did so, completed a week, that's the wedding week with Leah, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Now he's a bigamist. Sowing and reaping. Sowing and reaping. Let me address that issue of Leah and Rachel. Why should Leah have been the one and only one and not Rachel? I think there's several reasons for it. One is, Leah's character is superior to that of Rachel. Leah's character is superior to that of Rachel. I believe she was a more spiritual person than Rachel. I believe that's evident from the way she named her children. The expressions that came from her about her children, about her relationship with God. I don't see this in Rachel. I think Leah was the more spiritual. Could I insert this? Men, young men, don't make your selection of your bride-to-be based just on physical appearance. Please don't. Now, that doesn't mean that you've got to go find an ugly one. The one that you will find will be beautiful to you. And that's the way it should be. But do remember this. If you go seeking based only on the eyes and the form, you may end up with a tragedy on your hands. You may end up with something plastic and something that will haunt you to the day you die. so be careful. Secondly, I see that Leah was God's choice. She was the mother of Levi and Judah. The priestly line and what? The messianic line. Leah, not Rachel. Though Joseph does get the attention in the rest of the book. Three, God did to Jacob what Jacob had done to Esau. God did to Jacob what Jacob had done to Esau. You see, God, in order to fulfill his purpose, used the deception of Laban. As God used the deception of Jacob over Esau, God still accomplished his purpose. You say, well, God... He makes mistakes, he makes wrong decisions, he sins, and though he even suffers the consequences of those sins, yet God still accomplishes his ultimate, his decreed purpose. So that's the lesson. At least those are the reasons Jacob should not have married Rachel. He's a bigamist. The Bible never commends bigamy or polygamy. Now the fact that we find Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and others who are bigamists or polygamists does not mean that the Bible teaches it. From the beginning, it was not so. Jesus said, one man, one woman. In every case of bigamy, you watch the problems that begin to come out of it. All of the complications, the jealousy, the bitterness, and the fighting, I guess it's probably there as a lesson to show us the complications that come by divorce when you get more than one in the family picture. Even if the divorce has biblical grounds, that doesn't eliminate the complications, doesn't it? Well, let's see. Well, Jacob, verse 30, went into Rachel also. Indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah. I'll underscore that word more than, because that's the key to what is said in verse 31. And he served with Laban for another 7 years. Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved. The Hebrew here is hated. How did Jacob hate Leah? In the fact that he loved Rachel more than. This is important. This helps us to understand the idiom in the New Testament. Hating father and mother. You are not to have ill will toward your parents in the name of the gospel in Christ. But your love for the Lord should be so great that in comparison to this, close earthly relationships appear as if they are unloved in regard to the Lord. It isn't that you don't, but it's a comparative. That's the whole point here. And Jacob loved Rachel so much, it appeared that he didn't love Leah. So, she came second to Rachel and poor Leah. She wasn't beautiful, though she was God's chosen, but she is really going to be afflicted over this. It will really afflict her. And out of this comes further discipline in Jacob's life. Leah conceived, and now through verse 35, children 1, 2, 3, and 4. And this sets the background for future doctrine and future historical material, so watch it carefully. The first, she bore a son and named him Reuben. Now, if you have a marginal Bible, you will want to notice the meaning of these names. They're all going to be significant, very significant, particularly when we come to the latter chapters of Genesis, when we see prophecy about these children and their future, their descendants. So the first is Reuben. To look upon is the meaning. Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. Poor Leah. She wants Jacob to love her so much, she names Reuben, look on me and love me. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved. He has therefore given me this son also. She named him Simeon, meaning hearing. The Lord's heard me. Poor Leah. You know, there's a lesson here. Having children won't solve your problems. It increases the problems. Now, they can be handled, but you will never solidify a relationship, increase love for one another by just having children. Sometimes a parent couple having problems, they think, well, we just have a child. Sometimes a young woman will think this. If we just have a child, he'll love me more. No. Then it becomes severely complicated in that now a child is brought into the picture and his responsibility. She conceived again, bore a son, said, now this time my husband will become attached to me, circle that word, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore, he was named Levi. Or as you'll notice in the margin, Lava, related to Levi, meaning attached. What's she doing in every name? Oh, she wants Jacob to love her. In every boy's name, will come in hearing. Come in, look on me and love me. Come in, attach to me. It's not working, though. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she called him Judah. Then she stopped bearing, at least temporarily. The name Judah means the one for whom Jehovah is praised. So there are his four sons by Leah. Could I pause and give you the three lessons that God is teaching? All, I think, come out of this sowing and reaping. But here they are, and let's take them now at this juncture. Here is the principle of sowing and reaping and God's lessons to Jacob. One, sin always bears consequences. Sin always bears consequences, both for time and eternity. Certainly it bears consequences in that you will have to answer to the Lord as an unbeliever in terms of your judgment in the lake of fire. As a believer in relation to rewards, sin always bears consequences. Jacob had acted in unbelief, hadn't he? He had. And so he is going to now be disciplined in that very area. He had deceived. He had acted in unbelief. Now, he is deceived, and he sees the consequences of it. He feels the pain of it for seven more years. I see something else here. That we are responsible for what we do. We are responsible for what we do. We can't say, oh, God was just forcing his purposes on me. I didn't have any choice. I'm suffering this. Your sin brought it upon you. If you're miserable, you are responsible. I'm responsible. I can't blame God. You ever heard anybody try to blame God for their misery? I have. Why is God doing this to me? Doesn't God hear me? I've prayed and prayed and God won't take it away. Or God. They brought the misery on. They made the decisions. They did this. A young woman will say, oh, why is God allowing me to live with this unsafe husband? You consented. You said out you would marry him. Who made you marry him? As if God forced them to get married. Don't forget that. Now, I know it's in the past. True, it is water under the bridge. But I feel it's necessary to remind sometimes a couple that. Well, they want to start bad-mouthing the other one. Don't you forget, hon, you asked, or you said yes when he asked you. You knew what you were getting into. And that's why I say to you single girls, listen carefully. You give it a long, serious thought before you say, yes, I'll marry you. I mean a lot of thought. Now, if it's the right one, things will click. Things will click. You won't have a lot of questions, and I don't know, and I'm not sure. Things will fall in place. But if you're not sure, you had better back away. Because if you make a decision to marry the wrong person, simply on physical attraction or some way in which you are trying to make circumstances a Bible. You know, he walked in the door and I just prayed that afternoon that God would bring the right one into my life. And then, bang, there he came, right in the back door. or there he was, or there she was at the party that night. Could you believe it? Introduced to me. You don't make a decision based upon an appealing set of circumstances. The only way you can verify those circumstances, or the only way they can have the significance, is for you to read them through Scripture. It could be the wrong one that's come, and it could be a test to see how much you are willing to serve, to want God's will more than anything else. This could be the wrong one coming across your path to test your faith and trusting God to bring along the right one. There's a third factor. He was not able, I think he learned this, that he was not able to go along on his own strength. Jacob was not able to go along on his own strength and ability. He found out what it got him into. Flexing those muscles, moving that stone, impressing Rachel. I'll serve you 7 years. I'll do this. I'll do that. Yeah, Jacob, and you've got what you asked for. You're suffering for it now. You've got wives that are jealous, children that'll be squabbling. How'd you listen, fellas? You think it's difficult with one wife and you squabble. How would you like to have two wives and have squabbling going on? Not only between you and them, but between one another. How would you like to be a full-time referee with two wives? Jacob got himself in that situation. The chickens come home to roost. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Now here's their family fight. First family fight on record between these two. Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel. He's mad at her. He said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? I mean, is it my fault? Am I the one who's responsible for this? I have nothing to do with it. I've not kept you from having children." She said, "Well, here's my maid Bilhah. Go unto her. She may bear on my knees that through her I too may have children." She gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife. And Jacob went into her. She conceived. Now we get the record of those children. Number 5, Dan. Then Rachel said, giving him Bilhah, "Another child, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed." She named him Naphtali. Verse 9, and then when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah. Now it's really getting complicated. And gave her to Jacob as a wife, and Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son, and Leah said, "How fortunate," that's the key to his name, named him Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Leah said, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy." So she named him Happy, or Asher. Now in the days of the wheat harvest, about May or June, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." What are mandrakes? You ever had a mandrake? It's nothing to do with the cartoon character. He's not still in there, is he? Some don't even know what I'm talking about. Boy, that's getting trouble now. Mandrake, the magician. It was in the comics. All right, forget that. Who is this? The mandrake was a fruit found in that part of the world. Not all that common. It was an herb of the belladonna family. And it was yellowish in color. All plum-like in size and plum-like in texture. Sweet to the taste. It was believed to have been an aphrodisiac, plus that it was supposed to have made one more fertile as well. Well, Rachel believes in that little bit of superstition. So here now, she is rendered to the point, or she is seen bargaining over mandrakes. I frankly am not all that impressed with Rachel. She might have had a nice looking body, but I don't think she had much between her ears when it comes to a lot of sense about spiritual things. I don't find Leah acting this way about her barrenness and her desire for her husband to love her. Now, Leah had her weak points, but let's watch this. She said to her, "It's a small matter for you to take my husband. Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? Would you also take my son's mandrakes also?" So here they are, sisters squabbling over the man's rakes. And she said, therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. So here are Jacob's wives arguing over who's going to get the mandrakes and who's going to be able to sleep with him that night. Came in from the field in the evening. Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I've surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he lay with her that night. Jacob gave heed to Leah. She conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband. She named him Issachar. And Leah said, another child, Zebulun, verse 20, number 10. Afterward, she bore a daughter, named her Dinah. This is not the only daughter she had. Her name means, though, vindications. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. Listen, the chickens have come home to roost. Jacob has gone to Haran, has not married the right one, married two, now has a family, and is being disciplined. The deceiver has been out deceived. It's boomeranged on Jacob. What must Jacob have thought? 450 miles from home, a growing family, but a squabbling family, serving because he'd been deceived. You think his mind ever went back those years before? God was teaching Jacob something. Now let's end on this note. What was God teaching Jacob? In addition to what I've already pointed out in the lesson of sowing and reaping, God was wanting Jacob to see that even though these things had happened to him, let's take the situation of Laban deceiving him. Jacob should have learned from that, that Jacob, as you have been deceived, don't deceive again. Don't rely on your own strength. See what it's like when it happens to you. Don't do this again. Learn to count on me, depend on me, and don't you try to force the issue, Jacob. I will accomplish my purposes. I am with you, Jacob. Jacob is going to learn some more lessons. His material prosperity, we'll study this, and his return to Canaan next Sunday evening. Let's close in prayer. Father, I ask that the lessons we've seen, may we learn, may the Spirit make the final application, so that there will be the honoring and the glorifying of your name in our life. In Christ's name I ask it. Amen.